You're listening to the weekly Portland podcast. For a complete list of episodes, visit pdxpod.com or find us on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Remember to like, share, and subscribe.
Our special guest today is New York Times best-selling legal thriller writer Philip Margolin. Philip is a contributor to Anatomy of Innocence, Testimonies of the Wrongfully Convicted. The book highlights the stories of 15 imprisoned Americans, all exonerated by the Innocence Project, a legal team focused on reviewing DNA evidence, misconduct, tortured confessions, and false witness identifications. In the book, Philip tells the tale of Bill Dillon, who became his own jailhouse lawyer. After Dillon had lost nearly all hope, an elderly inmate in the prison library suggested that he file a motion for DNA testing, which eventually led to Bill's freedom after serving 20 years for a murder he didn't commit. My name is Gregory Day, and you're listening to the weekly Portland podcast. I've recently started a book club. We're called Audiobook Club PDX. We meet the first Monday of each month. November 6th is the first meeting on the 8th floor of the Nines Hotel. We're an open forum discussion group, so just feel free to blab on and on about any audiobook that you've listened to that month. Okay, since we don't have any ads on this show, because I hate ads, they're really annoying, we're going to jump right to it. Let's meet our special guest today, Philip Margolin and I, having a chat at the Nines Hotel.
I mean, I was a criminal defense lawyer for 25 years, and I actually, on my own, got two innocent people out of prison who'd been convicted of murder. And it's not good. I mean, even if nothing horrible, in the prison movies, there's always gang fights and people being stabbed. And if you read the chapters in Anatomy of Innocence, there was some of that, but then a lot of the guys just were able to keep to themselves. But, the biggest thing I've always heard from people I represented that's the worst part of prison is the boredom. It's not having to fight off a gang. It's just going through day after boring day that's identical to the day before and is going to be identical the day after. No intellectual stimulation and, people telling you what to do 24 hours a day, when to get up, when to go to sleep, what you can eat. Mm-hmm. And you might, the food's not Michelin star restaurant quality food. You're not getting great food. And
right.
So it's just, even if it's not a dangerous and it can be. I mean, obviously, I always describe prison as all the guys that were, the bullies in high school. Well, they're all in one place now. So, it can be a very unpleasant group of people that you're with.
Can you tell me how the Anatomy of Innocence book came together?
Yeah, Laura Caldwell's idea. She's a mystery writer, fairly well known, who also was a professor, I think, at Loyola University Law School in Chicago. But she additionally started this Life After Innocence project with people at the college or at the law school. And Les has written, he won the Edgar for the annotated Sherlock Holmes, and he's done the annotated Dracula, and there's a lot of stuff in the mystery field. And so the two of them got the idea of a way of raising funds for the project. And what they did was they were asked best-selling mystery writers like Lee Child, Scott Trow, myself, Jan Berkley. There's a number of them in the book to pair up with a exoneree, and then write a chapter for the book that highlighted a turning point in their getting out of prison? Where was the turning point in their case that allowed them to be exonerated? In this case, we were just paired with people. We didn't pick them out. And I got in touch with Bill Dillon and Ellen, his girlfriend or wife, like I said. I'm not sure exactly whether they're married yet. But and I had a lot of help from them because they had written a book about Bill's case. And so I sort of asked them what was the big turning point, and they'd actually written a chapter about this fellow in the prison coming up to him, and so I took a lot of that chapter, but then I rewrote it to make it a little bit more dramatic. But I would say a good part of what's in my chapter that I wrote was done with the help of Ellen and Bill, and then I read what they wrote, and I wrote a draft, and then I sent it to them, and to make sure I was getting things right, or to see if there were things that they wanted to change around. And then we after going back and forth with their edits, then I eventually we got the chapter to where they thought that this was good enough to submit, and then I sent it to Laura and Les. So it really was a collaborative effort. My first book I wrote in 1978, and it had a male protagonist. And after the book was published, my editor asked me if I would like to do a series with a female prosecutor for pocketbooks. And I think I was 34. And I panicked, and I said, I wouldn't know how to write a female lead, and I turned it down. I was just terrified of the idea of having to write a female main character. So the next book that I wrote had a male, and I took a 12-year break because my law practice got really exciting, and so I didn't write a book for 12 years. And then when I got the idea for my third book, I intended to have a male main character, and it was the same guy that was in The Last Innocent Man, my second book. And the story revolves around a serial killer who is, I tried to create the most horrible person who ever lived for the book. And he kidnaps and tortures women and attempts to dehumanize them before he kills them. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm writing this scene where Martin Darius, who's a multimillionaire, and he's the one that police suspect is a Rose killer, meets with his male lawyer. And it's in a high-rise office building, but after hours when, only the cleaning crews are around and it's really dark. Well, I've represented serial killers and a number of murders. Yeah, I represent about 30 people charged with homicide of some sort. And, anytime you're sitting in a room with a contact visiting room with someone who's killed someone, your antenna's up a little bit. But if the guy's a serial killer who kills women and you sort of know you're not his type, you're a lot less nervous. And so I'm thinking to myself, gosh, if instead of a male lawyer, it was a female lawyer in this darkened 40-story building, all alone, the tension level would be through the roof. And so I made a decision that I would have to deal with my fear of females and do a sex change operation on my main character, make her into a woman. And then I thought to myself, well, how am I going to do this? And then I thought, who's the toughest guy I know? And I was married for 38 years. My wife passed away in 2007, but my wife was also an attorney. And she was a real, she's really a phenomenal person. And I thought, well, I'll just imagine Doreen in every scene where Betsy Tannenbaum, who's the heroine in Gone but Not Forgotten, I'll just imagine Doreen in each scene and just write what Doreen would do. And so that sort of helped me get over my fear of females. And by the time I finished the book, I realized it wasn't that difficult to write a female character. So then about half my characters, my leads, are women, to the point where I was accused on occasion of pandering to women because women read more than men. But that's actually not true. What I do is with each book, I try to decide, you know, who's the most appropriate lead character? Well, who are the appropriate characters in the book? And it just so happened that, you know, for the reason I explained in Gum, and I forgot, it had to be a woman attorney. But the next book I wrote had a male main character, and so I bounced back and forth. And with Amanda, I just thought no one had ever had, at least to my knowledge, a father-daughter criminal defense team. So in Wild Justice, which was supposed to just be a standalone, wasn't supposed to be a series, I introduced Amanda and her father, Frank Jaffe, who's one of the top criminal defense lawyers in Oregon. And Amanda in that book is just fresh out of a clerkship and just never tried a case. And she's working for her father, which she thinks about whether does she want to do this, you know, be in his firm. But they get along great, so she does it. And then I just finished that book and didn't think about Amanda anymore. And then the next book, The Associate, I wrote, I had nothing to do with the Jaffes, but I have a young attorney who is arrested and charged with murder he didn't commit, so he has to have a lawyer, and I was going to invent one, and I thought, I like that Amanda character, maybe I'll just give her a cameo role. And then the book right after that, Ties That Bind, I didn't have the Jaffes at all in the outline for the book, but as I was working through it, I thought, you know, the Jaffes would fit in here, and I've never done a series where I continue the life of a character. I didn't know if I could do it, and I thought that would be the challenge that would, you know, that really interested me. So
great continuity there.
Yeah, and it worked out. But now what I do is I had Amanda's been in five novels, but they're big, you know, other books that go in between them.
So Amanda is essentially the reincarnation of your wife.
Not Amanda. It was Betsy Tannenbaum.
Okay, Betsy Tannenbaum, okay.
And she said that was a standalone. She's never been back. But, you know, the concept of a very self-sufficient, confident woman came from my wife.
Oh, that's a great story.
Really smart, too. Very, very brilliant and, you know, a tough guy, so.
One thing I do love about your work is referencing so many real Portland locations.
Well, that's because I'm lazy. You know, if I set the things in Timbuktu, I'd actually have to go and
Forest
do,
Park, see? Lloyd Center, downtown Multnomah.
I love Portland. I moved out here in 1970 from New York. I grew up on the East Coast.
I can sense that New York accent, yeah. Yes.
And I was in the Peace Corps in Liberia, West Africa, in between college and law school, and did my training in San Francisco, and just fell in love with the West Coast. And so my plan was 2 years Africa, come back to law school on the East Coast, and then get the hell out as quick as I could, and ended up in Oregon in 1970 and never left. And I just love the place. I go all over the country, and actually I've been all to Europe and Canada on book tours, and I wouldn't live anywhere else than Portland. I love Portland. People who tell me, you know, I start talking about to shut up because I sound like I'm a Chamber of Commerce representative. But you know, it's great. In The Associate, I was trying to figure out where are we going to have the heroine and the hero meet. And my office is right over Pioneer Square. And so I said, I just looked at, there's a big Starbucks there. So I put them in. So it helps to live here. Then I don't have to go fly to Phoenix, Arizona, or, you know, South Dakota to ride. I just drive around the streets.
Well, you certainly are prolific. It really, you know, makes me connect with a book in a whole new way. So you do a lot of public speaking, and you went on a book tour for the last book, Violent Crimes. And can you tell us about, you know, what do you give away? Do you dangle a carrot for the readers?
No, you know, it actually, the book tours are interesting because they've changed dramatically since I started. In 1993, my first bestseller came out, and I was doing 26 cities in 6 weeks. So you're constantly, every night almost, giving a talk about writing. And over the years, I've developed several different talks. I auction myself off Murder Margolin and Merlot for charities where I help raise money for diabetes and cancer, breast cancer, and all sorts of stuff, and go to people's houses. So I have do a lot of speaking for that, and then I do it about Chess for Success, which is a nonprofit that I helped form with two other people back in the 90s. So I'm always doing public speaking. But with the books, I have three or four speeches, and depending on how long I'm supposed to talk and what I'm in the mood to talk about, I change it up a little. When I have a new book, I usually talk about where I get the ideas for books from, and then we'll end up explaining where I got the idea for the latest book. And right. Sometimes I just talk about how I got published, which is very weird, and how I became a best-selling author, which was equally bizarre. So it's, you know, it's various things. It depends on how, do I have an hour to talk, do I have 20 minutes, so...
You know, when I called you, you sounded very excited about your current project, the current mm-hmm. book you're working on. You're working on some angles, right?
Well, what I'm excited about, I'm actually have a new book with a new series coming out in March of 2018, and the book's called The Third Victim, and the idea for it came from a very unusual place. The coolest thing is where ideas come from. And they just sort of like come from all sorts of places. Sometimes one day I was walking down the street and I, for no reason whatsoever, the phrase, the Courthouse Athletic Club popped into my head. To this day, I don't know why. And I was saying, that would be a good title for a book. What would that be about? And then I thought clubs are like conspiracies, groups of people getting together to do something. And I'd never written a book about a conspiracy. So I thought, what kind? Courthouse, lawyers, judges and policemen getting together to do evil things, and that over the years morphed into a book. So with this one, I haven't practiced law since 1996. I practiced for 25 years, but I've been writing full-time, but I still subscribe to Oregon State Bar Journal and other bar journals, and they had an article about what do you do when the senior partner in a big law firm who's a big rainmaker for the firm, maybe he was the president of the Oregon State Bar, starts to show signs of dementia. And so I thought, well, that'd be an interesting situation to put another lawyer in. So Robin Lockwood is the heroine in my new series, and she worked her way through Yale Law School fighting mixed martial arts tournaments and was nationally ranked. She gets her job at a law school clerking for the Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court, and then gets her dream job. And the dream job is to be an associate in the firm of Regina Barrister, who is a dynamic woman in her late 50s who is considered to be the queen of the Oregon State Criminal Bar. And she's known for her brilliance and wins cases all the time. And immediately after getting hired, they are, after coming on board, they're hired, the firm, to represent a lawyer, a senior partner of a big firm, who the police claim is a horrifying serial killer. And they get the case, and then it's not clear whether he's guilty or not. And as they get involved in this death penalty murder case, Robin starts to suspect that Regina... there's something wrong with Regina, and she has no medical training and has never been in court. So she doesn't know what's normal for a trial lawyer, and she doesn't know what the signs of dementia are, but she begins to think that they could be in big trouble, because if she screws up, Regina screws up, this guy could die. But what do you do? You're a neophyte attorney. Are you going to tell, you know, your boss, who's one of the most honored lawyers in the whole state, Did you think she's losing her mind? So there are two parallel themes running through the book. One, it's a terrific mystery, legal thriller with a what I think is one of my best surprise endings, but it's also about dementia and Alzheimer's. And I did a ton of research on it, and actually in real life went through full-blown dementia with my aunt and my mother-in-law. So I've actually seen the horrible things that happen when someone does get full-blown Alzheimer's and dementia. And so it's a there's two things running through the book, and I was very excited about it from the standpoint of creating a really cool mystery with a really neat twist, but also talking about what's a very serious problem in modern society. Chess is the single best educational tool in the world, and that sounds like an incredibly over-the-top statement, but I'm going to prove it to you. Most people don't realize this. There's a secret about chess. After four moves on either side of the board, the number of potential moves in a game are more than all the atoms in the universe. And if that sounds insane, look it up on Google it. You know, I've seen the number, other numbers, and they're just like unbelievable, but it's true. So Chess for Success, we're in 82 elementary schools, Title I. Title I schools are schools where the children in the school, a certain high percentage, I think it's 35 or more, and 70% of the kids in our school, 82 schools, are qualify for free breakfast and lunch because their family income's low enough so that they qualify. So we're in these schools, and Chess for Success pays a school teacher in the school to run an after-school chess program for 1 hour and 15 minutes twice a week. And what happens is this. Little kids want to win games. They're really motivated. Most board games, in order to make your move, you spin a dial or you throw dice. But in chess, after a certain short number of moves, the number of viable moves, realistic moves, are usually four or five. And in order for the child to figure out what to do, they have to put their feet on the floor. They have to totally focus on the problem, which is what moves should I make? They can't talk. They can't look around because it's very complicated. And then they have to go through each possibility. If I move my knight, this, and this can happen. Then they have to compare and contrast. Okay, this could happen with the knight, but what if I move the bishop? Is that better or worse? And then once they do figure out their move, they have to reevaluate to see if they still agree that that's what they want to do. And if you think about it, that's what a child has to do to read a book.
That's critical thinking right there.
You have to read a book with comprehension, solve math problems. Anything as an adult you do as a lawyer or in business. Should I buy this house? I want to buy a house. It's beautiful. I love it. But what are property taxes? What's my income? How much can I afford for the mortgage? That's chess. So what we're doing is we're basically training kids to sit still and shut up and focus. And we give them a system of analysis.
I like it already.
It's very simple, but the U.S. government funded a two-year study of our program. Now, again, you have to remember the kids that we're working with are supposed to be the dummy failures. They're the poor kids. They're not from the affluent neighborhoods. And the study was a two-year study by the Northwest Regional Education Lab, which is now, I think it's Education Northwest, but it's one of the best educational testing services in the United States. And their bottom line was that 93% of the kids in our program met or exceeded the math standards for the state as compared to 88.6% for the rest of the state. 91% of our guys met or exceeded the reading standard compared to 86%, and those are both statistically significant differences. So simply by playing chess the right way, these kids were, without realizing it, training themselves to be good students. And we've been around for 25 years now. We started with 9 schools back in 1992, we're up to 82. And I think we're like 21 or 22 school districts around the state. And the best thing about it is we are the most fiscally conservative group on the planet. Our budget for about 82 schools is roughly $250,000. And, you know, lest you think there's just like three guys, our average club's 40 kids, and we have a number of clubs where it's well over 100.
That's money well spent.
Yeah, and if it gets more bang for the buck. It's about $150 per kid per year for about 50 hours at
an
after
hour
school.
Away from the phones and the video games.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the other thing. You have to interact with a human being if you play chess. So it's socialization. And, you know, they've found in some of the schools when we get enough kids in the chess club, a lot of the other problems in the school, like truancy, fighting, a lot of stuff goes down. There's a lot of spinoff that you wouldn't even think about. I think NBC News many years ago interviewed some kids on a Harlem chess team that had won the National Junior High School Championship. These were all really poor kids. And there were a couple of special ed kids that they interviewed who made the team. And they asked me, you know, what has chess done for you? And I thought he'd say, oh, you know, my math scores have gone up. He said, before I started playing chess, if someone did something, I'd fight. I'd hit them. But now I know you have to think before you act. And so there's a lot of stuff you learn from chess, not acting impulsively. Because with chess, a lot of times there'll be a sexy move that you think, oh, I'm going to do this. But if you look at it and you sit back and take your time, feet on the floor, focus, go through, you realize it's a bad move because not now, but five moves later, you're going to get clobbered. So there's a lot of spinoff from just simply playing chess that most people don't think about because they just say, oh, yeah, it's a little nervous.
I have never looked at it from that perspective. That is fascinating.
The other point I like to make is a lot of people say, well, of course you guys do better in school because they're all 200 IQ nerds with little pocket protectors. We have a bell curve. We have a lot of special ed kids in our program. Very few of the kids are talented and gifted because there aren't that many talented gifts. So if you have 100 kids in your chess club or 40 kids in the chess club, you're not going to have a lot of them talented and gifted. So it just affects all kids. There's a study in Houston where they actually divided up between talented, gifted, average, and special ed. And they found significant differences in performance for the talented, gifted, the average students. And there was improvement with the special ed kids. It wasn't statistically significant, but it was the kids were definitely doing better. So I'm not as active. I do a lot of fundraising, talk to potential donors. You know, literally, I mean, the only problem we have, this program, now this is amazing. We're a nonprofit. We have never had a single complaint about the program from anyone. I mean, I know Planned Parenthood can't claim that. Most programs have somebody who calls up and says, this stinks or you're ruining my kid. We've never had in 25 years anybody complain about the program. So the program works beautifully. Our problem is we want to keep expanding it so more kids can get in. So it's money, just raising enough funds to expand the program so it gets to more and more schools. Right. So like I said, we started with 9 in 1992, and now we're up to 82, and there's, I think, 600 Title I schools in the state. And then, you know, if Bill Gates gave me a $1 billion check, I'd put it in all the schools, you know. But we just put it in Title I because we had to figure out where is the money best spent. It's obviously not in a private school or a school that's not Title I where they have a lot of money in the school. The neat thing about my website is that, and I think it's www.philipmarglin.com. It's Philip with two L's. But you can actually contact me, and people do it all the time. So
I did.
Yeah, there's a contact Phil. So I get several people all month long who will say the good ones are, I really liked your book, and the other ones, which I actually appreciate, are, I just read your book and you know you screwed up. You said this ballistics test would work, but it would never. So I always actually I appreciate that because over the years I've had readers pick up screw ups in the books, and I always love it.
Really?
Because you have copy editors and your editor and stuff gets through. I had one. one book where the detectives are going to go up to interview a guy on the fourth floor, and they get off on the ninth floor. So, you know, so it's fourth floor one page and the ninth floor the next page. And, you know, usually you catch that eventually, but stuff sneaks through. So, and they just, people asking, when's your next book going to come out, or anything they're interested in. I'm so excited to have ever published the book that I still get really, you know, the fact that someone's read my book and has taken the time to contact me, I still really appreciate it. So,
the new book, Anatomy of Innocence, that's for a great cause.
Yeah, and people should buy that book because that money does go. The stories in it are just chilling. I mean, every single story is about an exoneree and how they got out of prison, but it's also about the problems of getting out after 25 years, problems of being in prison. How do you deal with being in prison when you're innocent? How did the guy get in? You know, torture in Chicago of people tortured into making false confessions and planting of evidence and all sorts of stuff. So every story is about someone who actually didn't do what they were sent to prison for and how that
terrifying
happened. Yeah, it's really scary stuff. It's not pleasant, but people need to be aware that this does go on. Unfortunately, it doesn't go on a lot. You know, as an attorney, I would tell you, you know, as a criminal defense attorney, most of the time the police do a great job. But every once in a while, something happens where you have a bad police officer. And like I say, the vast majority, I think, are very honorable. They have a horribly difficult job. And I've really gained tremendous respect over the years for them. But you have bad apples in every profession. Lawyers, doctors, you know, garbage men. There's always some guys in those professions that are terrible people. And in some cases, it's intentionally putting a person in that they know didn't do it. Other cases, it's sloppy work. And then some cases, just honest mistakes by an eyewitness. So the stories are fascinating. And like I said, the money goes to a terrific cause.
And can you tell me a bit more about that cause?
It's life after innocence. And again, they help exonerees, because you think, oh, it's great, the guy get out, isn't that terrific,
get a bunch of money.
Yeah, but well, some don't, some states,
some
do,
don't,
some states do reimburse and some states don't.
Some don't.
Yeah, or they'll give insignificant amounts. So
for an innocent person locked up.
Yeah,
incredible.
Yeah. So, you know, it's it varies from state to state as to how much you can get, but even that, you know, let's say you get out after 25 years and they give you $1 million. You're just getting back into society, trying to get a meaningful life.
You're
after
reading
you've been
about
locked up.
What William had to go through after 27 years locked up.
So, I mean, there's more to it than just, oh, it's cool, guy's out, now let's go on and do some, you know, let's go to the movies. It's the guy's out and he's got to figure out how to adjust to a world that has passed him by. A lot of guys went in before cell phones, the internet.
This organization helps them adjust to modern life.
It helps, yes. And it's a wonderful organization.
Cell phones, right. Yeah. If you've been locked up for 15 years, you don't know what the hell is going
25
on.
25 years,
incredible.
30 years in one case.
Incredible. Yeah. 30 years? Really?
Yeah, the first guy to get off, there's a Kirk Bloodworth, his story's in the book. He was the first person on death row to be exonerated by DNA evidence. So he was locked up for 30-something years.
Remarkable.
Yeah. So people, it's a fascinating read, because I read all the stories besides just my own. So I read the other ones, and it's just, I practiced for 25 years, and like I said, I had my own personal experience getting two totally innocent people out of prison after they've been convicted for murder and sentenced to life in prison. And that's the worst thing. Everyone thinks that every lawyer wants to represent an innocent person. Quite frankly, you ask any criminal defense lawyer, that's the last type of person they want to represent, because it scares the hell out of you. You know, if a guy robs a store and they have him on videotape and then he confesses.
What a responsibility.
Yes, because if you mess up, you know, the guy's going to stay in prison. And you know in your heart and factually that the guys didn't do it. So I hated those cases. They, I loved doing them when they were finished, because it's two of the things I'm most proud of, getting these guys out. But while I was doing it, I wasn't sleeping, and I'm usually really laid back with my cases. You know, I just treat them like I'm a mechanic. But with those cases, you don't sleep, and, you know, you feel like, did I do enough? Is there something else I should do today that I didn't do? So.
Right. Wow. Wow, that's the Amanda Jaffe character. Mm-hmm. A lot of integrity, a lot of hard work. This was fascinating. Eye-opening. I think I'm going to go start playing chess again. This was really...
It'll help you with your concentration.
Yes, I hope so. And preparation.
And your math skills. So.
Right. Thank you so much, Philip. This was a lot of fun.
And thanks for giving a big plug for the book, because it's for a good cause.
And thank you for listening to the Weekly Portland Podcast at pdxpodcast.com. My name is Gregory Day. We will see you next week. Please join me. Why?